Test for English Majors 2019 Grade 8 Part 1 Listening Comprehension Section A Mini Lecture In this section, you will hear a mini lecture. You will hear the mini lecture once only. While listening to the mini lecture, please complete the gap-filling task on Answer Sheet 1 and write no more than 3 words for each gap. Make sure what you fill in is both grammatically and semantically acceptable. You may use the blank sheet for note-taking. You have 30 seconds to preview the gap-filling task. Now, listen to the mini lecture. When it is over, you will be given 3 minutes to check your work.
Body language and mind. Good morning, everyone. In today's lecture, I'd like to focus on how our body language reveals who we are. We are really fascinated with body language and particularly interested in other people's body language. You know, we are sometimes interested in an awkward interaction, or a smile, or a contemptuous glance, or maybe a very awkward wink or handshake. So what kind of body language am I talking about? I'm interested in power dynamics, that is, the non-verbal expressions of power and dominance. And what are non-verbal expressions of power and dominance? Well, this is what they are. In the animal kingdom, non-verbal expressions of power and dominance are about expanding. So you make yourself big, you stretch out, you take up space, and you are basically opening up. And humans do the same thing. So they do this when they are feeling powerful in the moment. And this one is especially interesting because it really shows us how universal and old these expressions of power are. For example, when athletes cross the finish line and they've won, it doesn't matter if they've never seen anyone do it. They do this. So, the arms are up in a V sign, the chin is slightly lifted. But what do we do when we feel powerless? We do exactly the opposite. We close up. We make ourselves small. We don't want to bump into the person next to us. And this is what happens when you put together high and low power. So what we tend to do when it comes to power is that we complement the other's non-verbals. What I mean is, if someone is being really powerful with us, we tend to make ourselves smaller. We don't mirror them. We do the opposite. I'm watching this behaviour in the classroom, and guess what I have noticed? I notice that MBA students really exhibit the full range of power non-verbals. They get right into the middle of the room before class even starts, like they really want to occupy space. When they sit down, they are sort of spread out. They raise their hands high. You have other people who are virtually collapsing when they come in. As soon as they, I mean other people, come in, you see it. You see it on their faces and their bodies. And they sit with their chairs and they make themselves tiny. And they will not fully stretch their arms when they raise their hands. I also notice another interesting thing about this. It seems women are much more likely to do this kind of thing than men. I mean, women are more likely to make themselves small. Women feel chronically less powerful than men, so this is not surprising. The second question concerns our minds. We know that our minds change our bodies, but is it also true that our bodies change our minds? And when I say minds, in the case of the powerful, what do I mean? I'm talking about thoughts and feelings and the sorts of physiological things that make up our thoughts and feelings. And in my case, that's hormones. I look at hormones. So what do the minds of the powerful versus the powerless look like? Powerful people tend to be, not surprisingly, more assertive and more confident, more optimistic. They actually feel that they're going to win, even at games of chance. They also tend to be able to think more abstractly. They take more risks. So, there are a lot of differences between powerful and powerless people. Physiologically, there are also differences on two key hormones. One is dominance hormone, and the other is stress hormone. What we find is that powerful and effective leaders have high dominance hormone and low stress hormone. What does that mean? That means power is also about how you react to stress. Once we did an experiment. We decided to bring people into the lab and run that little experiment. These people adopted, for 2 minutes, either high power poses or low power poses. We, for 2 minutes, say, you need to do this or this. And we also want them to be feeling power. So after 2 minutes, we will ask them, how powerful do you feel? On a series of items, and then we give them an opportunity to gamble. Before and after the experiment, we take their samples of saliva for a hormone test. That's the whole experiment. And this is what we have found. Risk tolerance, which is gambling, what we find is that when you're in the high power pose condition, 86% of you will gamble. When you're in the low power pose condition, it's down to only 60%. And that's a pretty significant difference. Here's what we find on dominance hormone. From their baseline when they come in, high power people experience about a 20% increase and low power people experience about a 10% decrease. So again, 2 minutes and you get these changes. Concerning stress hormone, high power people experience about a 25% decrease. And the low power people experience about a 15% increase. Once again, 2 minutes led to these hormonal changes that configure your brain to basically be either assertive, confident, or really stress reactive. And, you know, feeling sort of shut down. And we've all had that feeling, right? So it seems that our non-verbals do govern how we think and feel about ourselves. Also, our bodies change our minds. So, power posing for a few minutes really changes your life in meaningful ways. When I tell people about this, that our bodies change our minds and our minds can change our behaviour and our behaviour can change our outcomes, they say to me, I don't believe that. It feels fake, right? So I said, fake it till you make it. I'm going to leave you with this. Before you go into the next stressful evaluative situation, for example, a job interview, for 2 minutes, try doing this. In the elevator or at your desk behind closed doors. And say to yourself, that's what I want to do. Configure your brain to do the best in that situation. Get your dominance hormone up and get your stress hormone down. Don't leave that situation feeling like, oh, I didn't show them who I am. Leave that situation feeling like, oh, I really managed to say who I am and show who I am. To sum up today, we talked about the non-verbal expressions of power and dominance and the strong effects of the change of behaviour. I suggest you try power posing, which is simple, but will significantly change the outcomes of your life. Okay, next time we are going to discuss the social functions of body language.
Now, you have 3 minutes to check your work. This is the end of Section A mini lecture. Section B, interview. In this section, you will hear two interviews. At the end of each interview, five questions will be asked about what was said. Both the interviews and the questions will be spoken once only. After each question, there will be a 10-second pause. During the pause, you should read the four choices of A, B, C, and D, and mark the best answer to each question on answer sheet 2. You have 30 seconds to preview the choices. Now, listen to the first interview. Questions 1 to 5 are based on the first interview.
Hey, Kathy, did you read this article in the magazine? I can't believe how much man is changing the planet.
Yeah, I had a look at it. Quite interesting, I suppose, if you believe that sort of thing.
What? What do you mean, if you believe that sort of thing? Are you saying you don't believe that we are damaging the planet?
To be honest, Mark, not really.
What are you saying? Are you saying global warming isn't a fact? Deforestation isn't a fact? The greenhouse effect isn't actually happening?
Hey, calm down, Mark. I just think too many people take these things as being definitely true without knowing all the facts.
You really don't think global warming is happening? You know, they've said sea levels are going to rise by quite a few meters over the next 50 to 100 years. Weather conditions are getting worse all over the world. Can you remember how many big hurricanes there have been in this country over the last few years? I think evidence is all around us.
I don't think we have enough information, to be honest. We've only been measuring these things for around 200 or 300 years. We have no idea what was happening 50,000 years ago. For all we know, this is just a natural blip, a kind of sudden but temporary change in the whole climate cycle. I don't think we should change how we're living just because of 20 years of abnormal measurements.
And don't you think all the other effects we're having on the planet are destructive?
What do you mean?
I mean, like deforestation, overpopulation, threatening the existence of many endangered animals, pollution of the air and the seas. I mean, I could go on if you want.
No, I understand what you're saying, and yes, it's true that there are several problems worldwide caused by human influence. I think the destruction of the Amazon rainforest is really dangerous, and it's something we could live to regret. I read somewhere that they were considered to be the lungs of the planet. And there we are, happily chopping it all down. And it would be a shame to lose some of those animals that may become extinct. You know, like the rhino or the panda. But I think we shouldn't interfere with nature. If they are going to become extinct, then we have to allow nature to take its course.
You've just contradicted yourself in two sentences, Kathy. First, you said it's bad that we're interfering with nature by destroying the rainforest, and then...
That's not the same thing.
Well, of course it is. The only reason 99% of these animals are endangered is precisely because we are threatening their habitats, either by chopping it down, as you say, or by expanding towns and farming into areas where these animals normally live and hunt. You can't destroy an animal's habitat and then turn around and say we can't interfere with nature to save it.
I don't think having 20 panda cubs in zoos around the world is a very smart way to save an animal. It's totally artificial and is cruel to the animals involved.
I would go along with that, yes. The real solution is to save the animal's original habitat.
This is the end of the first interview. Questions 1 to 5 are based on what you have just heard. Question 1. What do the speakers mainly talk about? Question 2. What does the woman think of global warming? Question 3. What is the man mainly concerned about? Question 4. What do the speakers both agree about on the topic? Question 5. What is the woman's attitude toward the topic? Now listen to the second interview. Questions 6 to 10 are based on the second interview.
Cindy, you've been doing research on disciplinary literacy for about 20 years now. In that time, you've probably been asked just about everything possible. What question comes up most often these days?
That's easy. We are doing better convincing teachers that disciplinary literacy is worth teaching, but they still are hesitant about their students' reactions. A teacher said to me recently, "I have enough trouble getting my kids to read a textbook chapter. How would I ever motivate them to read in a disciplinary way?"
Is that a real question, or is it just a mask for teacher resistance?
I think it's a real question, and in fact, it is also our biggest problem, because many teachers still don't understand the distinctions between content area, reading, and disciplinary literacy.
What is disciplinary literacy anyway? You said that's different.
Disciplinary literacy doesn't promise to make someone a better student. It invites students to join the disciplinary field itself. It's a kind of invitation to join a club.
Does it mean it invites students to join the history club by reading like a historian, or the science club by reading like a scientist?
Right, but it goes beyond that. It says, "We want you to join us. We want to share with you our cognitive secrets, our way of thinking about the world, and how we solve problems. We want to count you as one of us." In doing that, it both holds out the promise of affiliation. Connecting with others is a big motivator, and the promise of greater competency with challenging tasks. Not competency in being a kid or a student, but competency in being successful with the kinds of things that adults do.
What about assessment? How do we test disciplinary literacy?
There aren't any standardized disciplinary reading or writing tests yet, but one can easily imagine how classroom assessments could change in the future as instruction becomes more disciplinary in focus.
Past assessments in history, literature, or science have aimed to find out if students had mastered particular information. Questions about content would certainly still have a place in disciplinary literacy, since knowledge matters in disciplinary literacy too. But what would a more disciplinary assessment look like?
I think a more disciplinary assessment would seek to find out whether students are interpreting such information in a sophisticated way, according to the traditions of that discipline. For example, a disciplinary test in history might ask not only what we know about a historical event, but how we know about it. Students would be questioned about the source of the information, the reliability of the source, and how the information matches with information from other sources. In cases where the information is contradictory, the assessment might ask students to determine whose account was more credible, requiring students to weigh evidence using the same kinds of criteria that historians use.
That sounds interesting.
Or a literature assessment might ask students to engage in deeper interpretation than in the past. Instead of asking about the theme of a story, for example, An assessment might ask students to determine alternative themes and to decide, based on text evidence, which one the author seemed most sympathetic to. In other words, it would ask the student to participate in the reading more as a literary critic than a student.
How should we prepare teachers to teach disciplinary literacy in teacher training institutions?
So far, teacher training institutions haven't done a very good job of helping subject matter teachers understand the discourse practices of their disciplines. So those practices often remain implicit, untaught.
I agree with that. But have you seen any good examples?
Sure, there are some examples of programs that do make disciplinary literacy practices explicit. The best of these programs, in my opinion, are the result of literacy and disciplinary experts collaborating to determine what these practices are and then engaging students in them.
This is the end of the second interview. Questions 6 to 10 are based on what you have just heard. Question 6. According to the woman, what is the biggest problem in teaching disciplinary literacy? Question 7. What does disciplinary literacy really mean? Question 8. What would a more disciplinary assessment ask students to do? Question 9. Which is the best practice in teacher training institutions to promote disciplinary literacy teaching? Question 10. What is the purpose of the interview? This is the end of Part 1 Listening Comprehension.